Welcome to Humanity Unshackled, the show that seeks to liberate all 8 billion of us from mortality, sickness, gravity, pain, and every kind of suffering. I am Rusty Burridge, alongside futurist David W. Wood. Hello, David.
Great to be here. Looking forward to more unshackling.
Me too. And our guest today is someone who advocates for the abolition of all suffering, the ultimate unshackling, I guess, not just for us humans, but for all sentient life. And he believes it can be done. He is the author of several books, perhaps the best known is The Hedonistic Imperative, but he also penned The Biointelligence Explosion and Can Biology Abolish Suffering? And indeed, there is a work currently underway entitled The Biohappiness Revolution. Welcome, David Pierce.
Rusty, it's very good to be with you. Hello, David. Good to hear from you again.
So I'm going to go with The Hedonistic Imperative, if that's all right, if that could be our entry point. I'm going to quote you. The Hedonistic Imperative outlines how genetic engineering and nanotechnology will abolish suffering in all sentient life. The abolitionist project is hugely ambitious, but technically feasible. It is also instrumentally rational and morally urgent. The metabolic pathways of pain and malaise evolve because they serve the fitness of our genes in the ancestral environment. They will be replaced by a different sort of neural architecture, a motivational system based on heritable gradients of bliss. States of sublime well-being are destined to become the genetically pre-programmed norm of mental health. It is predicted that the world's last unpleasant experience will be a precisely datable event. Okay, so I don't know what heritable gradients of bliss means. I'll get a proper definition from you in a minute. But my kind of Philistine reaction is that many philosophers hold that pain avoidance and the pursuit of pleasure are two dynamic poles of the same drive. They are to some extent an engine. And if we remove one of those poles, i.e. pain, we remove a motivational dynamic and we lose both mojo and a sense of worth or accomplishment. I got to say, this is not my view. I am well up for infinitely scalable bliss. So David Pierce, what does heritable gradients of bliss actually mean? And if we remove all unpleasant experiences, do we lose the joy of being battered and bleeding, having given something of ourselves, only to emerge victorious and expanded and able to brag about it afterwards, i.e. a fight with a shark in which we're victorious? So exquisite pain, if you will.
Okay, a lot to tackle there. Yes, you quoted my purple prose from The Hedonistic Imperative, which was written in 1995. This was before the human genome was decoded or anything. But yes, essentially, I stand by that introduction. Okay, what do information-sensitive gradients, genetically programmed bliss, what does this actually mean? Let's unpack the term. Let's assume that rather schematically today, hedonic range as a species, or in fact for across the animal kingdom, is minus 10 for abject misery and despair, hedonic zero, that's emotionally neutral experience, and plus 10 sublime ecstasy. And most people spend most of their lives a little bit above or a little bit below hedonic zero, responding adaptively to different good and bad stimuli. But at the extreme, there are some people, tragically, who spend their lives in states of chronic misery and depression. There are also a lucky minority of people, including a number of transhumanists I personally know, who go through their lives animated by gradients of well-being. And the gradients, information-sensitive gradients, this is really important because if we are to preserve complex life and civilization, we have to respond adaptively to good and bad stimuli. Now, even before the human genome was decoded, we knew from twin studies, i.e. studies of monozygotic and dizygotic twins, that essentially your hedonic range and hedonic set point had a very high degree of genetic loading. And thanks to a revolution in molecular biology, we are starting to tease out the biological genetic basis of the hedonic treadmill and hedonic range. And it would be now possible, technically, at least in principle, to offer all prospective parents pre-implantation genetic screening, counseling, and even CRISPR genome editing, so they can choose benign variants of a handful of critical genes, enabling them to choose the pain thresholds and approximate hedonic set points and hedonic range of their future children. Now, this sounds incredibly far out, wild-eyed transhumanist stuff, but it's worth recalling that the World Health Organization defines health in its founding constitution as a state of complete physical, emotional, social well-being. Now, the transhumanist conception of health is, in some senses, less ambitious. I'm arguing for information-sensitive gradients of well-being, not complete well-being, complete health. But the only way to achieve good health, as defined by the World Health Organization, is to tackle the biological genetic roots of the problem. Now, any serious approach to tackling the problem of suffering has to think of non-human animals. It also has to think of existing sentient beings, too. And yeah, revolutionary breakthroughs here. This year marks the treatment of a severe progressive disease, transthyretin amyloidosis, with a one-off CRISPR injection that essentially corrects a dysfunctional protein. In principle, there is no reason why existing humans can't have CRISPR infusions to genetically correct existing disorders, not merely of the flesh, but also of the spirit, or in more physicalist language, to improve everything from their hedonic range, hedonic set point, to pain thresholds. The final limb of the abolitionist project, at least on Earth, will involve non-human animals. Some of it is extremely low-tech, getting factory farms and slaughterhouses shut and outlawed. And the most sociologically realistic way to do this is going to be accelerate the development and commercialization of cultured meat and animal products. But an appalling amount of suffering exists in the rest of the living world too. And recent developments, notably the use or the greater understanding of gene drives, and in particular the potential of synthetic gene drives, in principle allows us to spread benign versions of happy genes, low pain genes across entire species, even if the particular mutation in question carries a fitness cost to the individual, which naively sounds completely ecologically illiterate. Gene drives cheat the laws of Mendelian inheritance. They're first going to be used to defeat probably vector-borne disease in Africa. They could be used for the purposes of compassionate ecosystem management. But back to your original question about information sensitivity, though in theory one could get all sentient beings wireheading, so to speak. Wireheading is just perpetual stimulation of the reward circuitry. This is not consistent with sophisticated, intelligent life and civilization. And as I would envisage the future of sentience, it's going to be a case of devising this new motivational architecture based entirely on information-sensitive gradients of well-being. A lot to unpack there. A lot of things could go wrong too.
A lot to unpack. One thing I quite to quickly nail down, David, is hedonic threshold, meaning both emotional and physical pain entwined, or is there like a separate scale for both when you talk about hedonic points?
They are clearly intimately linked, emotional and physical pain. nonetheless, it is a useful distinction to make between physical and emotional pain. Something like the far and far out genes, for example, they mediate levels of anandamide from the Sanskrit for bliss. And the way the anandamide molecule interacts with the opioid system seems to have profound effects both on pain thresholds and emotional well-being. It's the dual role of far and far out came to the attention of medical professionals only a couple of years ago. The Joe Cameron case. I don't know if you saw it.
I was just about to link in to Joe Cameron, like genes we can plunder. Yes.
Yeah. It's not merely that she has an extraordinarily high pain threshold. Childbirth felt like a tickle, which I'm told by people who have given birth without anesthesia is not how it's normally experienced. But not merely that, she is essentially never anxious, never depressed, and yet she is a highly socially responsible, highly functional human being. In some ways, she's not an ideal case study because her nociception is impaired. Although eventually I think we can go on to essentially abolish all experience below hedonic zero, the first step is to essentially ensure everyone has an extremely high level of well-being, both physical and mental. But yeah, it's obviously critically important to preserve nociception, critically important to make sure people can respond adaptively to bad stimuli. And what's particularly fascinating, I mean, it's naively, yeah, you or I can't possibly benefit from Joe Cameron's dual unusual and dual
just to quickly qualify, but David,
the beauty of, yeah.
Joe Cameron has an almost or beyond Rasputin-like physical pain tolerance, doesn't she? And there's nothing, it doesn't seem that there's anything traded off here. So she's a great example of what it might be like to sort of live in a world where the pain system is merely an alert system rather than this over disproportionate punishing system that happens way after the danger has arrived and damaged you. Yeah?
Yeah, and in principle, at any rate, it should be possible to use gene therapy to give URI Joe Cameron's, the functional equivalent of Joe Cameron's far and far out genes. However, I am glossing over all kinds of complications in that because Joe Cameron is such a happy soul, she doesn't neurotically worry about some of the things you or I would do. She doesn't have the same degree of, shall we say, depressive realism that some of us have. That said, known biases can be corrected for. But yeah, if we as a civilization, and this is a very big if, were to take the World Health Organization definition of health seriously and aim for a hypothymic civilization in which everyone was exceptionally temperamentally happy, high hedonic set points, one needs to consider the issue of, yes, well, what about depressive realism? What about risk taking? Some very, very weighty, serious issues here. But I mean, clearly, humanity would not embark on a project like this without a lot of soul searching, agonizing, philosophizing, researching. It's not as though there is any kind of global consensus. Sooner or later, someone is going to mention the E word, i.e., eugenics. But nonetheless, it is technically feasible. In the long run, I think it's sociologically realistic, and I suspect it's going to happen. Though timescales, I would like the talk of timescales of a global 100-year plan to defeat suffering. Realistically, I still think centuries of needless pain and suffering still lie ahead.
For sure, but I'm sure there's some localized starting points that we can get to. I would ask on the Jo Cameron front, so she has this remarkable pain threshold. I have read that she only knows she's burnt herself from the smell of burning hair or flesh. She really is that immune to physical pain. And is there a trade-off? Does she lose sensuality and maybe even empathy? Do they know the ecstasy of a near-freezing Coca-Cola as it enters the mouth and slips down the throat?
All the indications are that, temperamental life lovers with very high hedonic set points get much more out of life. There is a risk that if one is temperamentally too happy, one just doesn't really understand the nature of suffering. One will be good-natured, but at the same time, not really fully be able to empathize with what it's like to suffer chronic pain and depression. And we can see this in the transhumanist and the effective altruist movement. Not all transhumanists or effective altruists think our number one problem is the problem of suffering. Having said that, other things being equal, being a fundamentally happy person, I would say generally will give one a much greater capacity, warmth towards others, whereas too much pain and suffering can embitter, make people twisted. It doesn't really make one a more loving person. But clearly there is a risk. One counterexample to the idea that happiness will make one less empathetic is the existence of hug drugs like MDMA or ecstasy. As you know, MDMA induces not merely euphoria, but a profound sense of love and compassion for oneself and for others. People spontaneously want to give each other hugs. MDMA induces the release not just a lot of serotonin and dopamine, but also a great deal of oxytocin. Sadly, one can't commend MDMA as the solution to all our problems. It's not sustainable. It's potentially neurotoxic. But nonetheless, one possible model of future society is a world in which we're all loved up and everyone loves everyone else. If it had helped our genes leave more copies of themselves in the African savannah, we would be in MDMA-like states right now. They're biologically feasible, but of course it wasn't. It has been genetically adaptive a lot of the time to be jealous, discontented, resentful, envious, sadly even sometimes spiteful, the whole nasty range of Darwinian emotions. And this, I think, is what we want to overcome, and it's going to be feasible with biological genetic interventions. You've probably noticed, to maybe disproportionate extent, I do focus on the biological genetic. In practice, what's needed is a twin track strategy in the realm of humans, everything from universal basic income to guaranteed access to healthcare, accommodation, a whole raft of measures. But the reason I personally focus so much on the biological genetic is that unless we tackle the negative feedback mechanisms of the hedonic treadmill, then essentially pain and suffering are going to persist indefinitely. We've got to tackle the fundamental roots of the problem of suffering.
I find myself agreeing with you largely, but I did find that well-being is contagious and it generates love and that kind of a thing. But I know that I've been through certain experiences that were highly painful, disproportionately so, and they created an expanded empathy for human beings. I was born empathic, but a lot of deep pain expanded those empathies. But there did come a point, I agree, where I just became bitter and twisted. After years of vagrancy, disenfranchisement and exclusion and disinheritance and excommunication, I at first it was a fashion accessory, and then I started becoming quite nasty So I think there comes a point where you can build a bit of muscle with painful experiences that expand your empathy, but there comes a point where you just become twisted. And I did enter into the twisted realm, it has to be said. So I agree with you on that.
Just as severely depressive people know they are miserable without, in some cases, even having the proper language to express it. It's just part of the fabric of existence. People at the other end of the scale, they most certainly know in a deep sense that they are happy, that the world is fundamentally good. I often quote transhumanist Anders Sandberg, "I do have a ridiculously high hedonic set point." But this wasn't something Anders spontaneously said. He was prompted. essentially, it is just normal for people who are temperamentally hypothymic to experience the world in this way. Yeah, they're not missing out, I promise. Too much empathy essentially would make one psychotic. If one could really glimpse even a fraction of the horrors of the world, one would go completely psychotic. I think one needs enough empathy to understand what needs to be done, but then one needs to be able to switch cognitive style and address the kind of the technical challenges, kind of biotech, getting involved in politics, the whole gamut of measures necessary to bring this vision to pass.
I totally agree. I think it's too much empathy put me at the bottom of the food chain. Combine that with a fantastic imagination, which of course is the mother of gullibility, and that did make me a very unsuccessful person for the majority of my life. So I totally agree. There is a kind of a petty psychosis attached to over empathy. I love the way you put that. I would like, if I may, to bring another quote from you to talk about that, and it is the following. "A lot of the time at present, we just don't and can't conceptualize the full extent of how unwell we are, for there are powerful arguments to suggest that everyday consciousness, insofar as it is not transcendently wonderful, is symptomatic of a profound psychological ill health." Eckhart Tolle said something very similar, that we're almost default these kind of rabid golems wandering around torturing ourselves, full of despair, guilt, and shame. Although I speak as a neurotic, I would say the majority of us are neurotic, and that's almost a default setting. I don't know if that's social pressures that put us that way, or if it's something you refer to as encephalization. Could you elaborate on the encephalization thing, David?
The encephalization is just a fancy way of saying that raw pain and raw happiness wouldn't be much good for promoting the inclusive fitness of our genes. But over time, our emotions have become complexified, such as you get people lying awake worrying about the price of Bitcoin, all kinds of crazy stuff like that. So yeah, encephalization of emotion. Yeah, sorry for the jargon.
And is that related to the kind of almost spooky horror story component that genes don't give a toss about us, and that some of our states of our noble states of altruism or well-being or care or love, any of it, are really to serve them and not us? That we're kind of living in this deluded prison.
From the perspective of the far future, and I mentioned earlier that, yes, schematically we could describe our hedonic range as minus 10 to 0 to plus 10. It'll be possible in the near-term future to construct a civilization with a hedonic range of, let's say, plus 10 to plus 20. But in future, yeah, in the far future, one can imagine a post-human civilization with a hedonic range of, let's say, plus 90 to a plus 100. But even a civilization with, let's say, a plus 10 to a plus 20 or a plus 30, by the lights of that civilization, all of us are just trapped in, yes, just sheer emotional squalor. And that the darkest depths of let's say a plus 30 to a plus 50 civilization are way more exalted than our peak experiences. If one is trying to pitch the message to a skeptical public, it's better to speak in terms of a language of remediation rather than enhancement, in that most people, or at least with some unease, will buy the notion of gene therapy to treat well-recognized genetic diseases. They're not comfortable, not at all comfortable, with the idea of gene therapy to enhance our emotional makeup, motivational architecture. But depending on how ambitiously you define health, most of us, maybe even all of us, are profoundly sick. I mean, by the World Health Organization definition of health, we are all sick to a greater or lesser extent. And so, yeah, particularly in front of a bioconservative or religious audience rather than transhumanists, it is best to talk in terms of the language of remediation, therapy, rather than radical enhancement.
Yeah, we have got a bit used to the sewer a little bit, haven't we? We often rationalise some of our darker tendencies. So would, you mentioned MDMA and ecstasy earlier, hug drugs, would they be examples, albeit kind of crude, naive ones, of a civilising neurotransmitter that you described in some of your work?
MDMA certainly does have this civilizing effect, at least for its duration. Jealousy tends to dissolve. One really does tend to have this sense of loving kindness that is just not physiologically possible for most of us in everyday life. While one is in an MDMA-like state of consciousness, one is profoundly vulnerable. You probably know this quote from Andy Grove, "Only the paranoid survive." Sadly, this is true in a Darwinian world. And yeah, essentially, sentient beings, human and non-human, are profoundly vulnerable in MDMA-like states, which why for the most part, they haven't evolved. And it would be fantastic if we can make the world safe for MDMA-like consciousness. I want to be a little cautious here, though, in that the more specific one's conception of utopia or of the good society one is, the more likely one is to be mistaken, and the more likely one is to get pushback from people who don't share your particular vision of the good society. But one of the beauties of hedonic recalibration, i.e. just ratcheting up hedonic set points and hedonic range, is that it doesn't involve imposing your or my vision of the good life or good society. It doesn't involve imposing your values or your preferences on anyone else. Essentially, take, just the average, let's say, bioconservative. Even a bioconservative loves waking up in the morning in an extremely good mood. All his or her kind of preferences and values and football team and goodness knows what else can be intact. In that sense, hedonic recalibration is conservative. And if we're trying to win over hearts and minds, it's worth stressing that critics don't need to buy into any specific transhumanist vision. Certainly not my vision of future life or us all being loved up on MDMA or anything like that. It's neutral with respect to people's conflicting preferences.
Yes, it's almost kind of love and let live. kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was a bit. Sorry. I couldn't resist it. But yes, it is, though, isn't it? Because it's not imperialist. It's not the sort of sanctimonious neoliberal sort of we know what's best for you kind of a gig. It is, no, we want to get you to a decent hedonic rating. And carry on with your pursuits from there, whether that's business or football or permaculture.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big problems is that both in humans and non-humans, so many of our naturally evolved preferences are inconsistent with each other. I mean, humans are social primates. Therefore, there is simply no way via social engineering one can create a society in which most people's preferences are satisfied. People enjoy competitive sports, but only one person can be world champion. Only one team can win the World Cup. There is logically no way to satisfy these preferences. However, what one can do by ratcheting up hedonic range, hedonic set points, is underwrite people's default quality of life. So in that sense, it's modest. In another sense, it's a revolution beyond our imagination. I mean, I talk about life based on gradients of intelligent bliss, but yeah, the lived experience is completely beyond me.
So is there likely to be, or is there, a watershed of civilizing neurotransmitters, or is that the sort of portal shorthand for what we want to achieve?
Good heavens.
I'm sorry, David Pearce.
No. Yeah, it's just, you know, neuroscience has got, you know, hung up on particular, at one stage it was dopamine that is this kind of the pleasure molecule and so on. It's much more complicated than that. I think one of the reasons we psychiatric medicine has been so disappointing over the past few decades is that the neurotransmitter system most directly involved in hedonic tone is the mu opioid system. And for obvious reasons, one cannot urge people to take opioid drugs, which simply kick the brain's negative feedback mechanisms into gear. However, looking slightly further ahead, we can choose benign genes and allelic variations for our future children. In the case of existing humans, and this is before the era of mature gene therapy, it should be possible, for example, to use something like ACKR3 receptor blockers. The ACKR3 receptor regulates endogenous levels of opioids in the CNS, your kind of default hedonic tone. And so rather than people who are experiencing pain and depression taking opioids, it should in principle be possible with the right designer drug targeted on the ACKR3 receptor to elevate hedonic tone. But this is very, very new, this research. There are going to be all kinds of technical problems here. There will need to be controlled clinical trials. Any potential wonder drug in the realm of psychiatric medicine that could well have side effects and abuse potential. In the long run, I think it is far better to engineer default well-being for our future children rather than to patch up existing dysfunctional Darwinian minds. But we need essentially a near term, a medium term, and a long term strategy.
You said before about sort of, I summed it up as love and let live. But you do have quite a grand worldview that would be considered controversial by bioconservatives, and that is that you include all sentient life. You want to see all sentient life suffering come to an end, and I think that you believe that you're able to restructure the entire Earth's ecosystem, cast off the shackles of Darwinian evolution and its historical indifference to the happiness of sentient life, all to the benefit of all sentient life. So I think So I think that's what you mean by paradise engineering. And it goes back a long way. It goes back to the Old Testament, you know, cats and dogs living together. It's a big project. It is a grand worldview. It is controversial. Is that really your mojo? Is that what you would like to begin?
Whenever one is broaching a really controversial topic that sounds crazy, it helps to invoke historical precedents, depending on one's audience, whether it is Gautama, Buddha, or the peaceable kingdom of Isaiah. The idea of phasing out predation and carnivorous predators in their existing guise is extremely controversial, which is why I normally start with the Bible and the book of Isaiah and how the Garden of Eden was originally vegan. This kind of scene setting. Now, take something like the future of predation. I personally, and I stress this is just my personal view, I would not be sad to see a world in which existing species of predators were peaceably, non-violently retired. But most people are aghast at the idea of a world without members of the cat family.
He's having a go at Tiddles now.
My little Tiddles wouldn't hurt a fly and so forth. But yeah.
We all know what murderous bastards cats are. So we got no illusions about that.
But nonetheless, thanks to biotech starting with stopgaps, we could use something like catnip-flavored cultured mincemeat, for example, and then going on to a bit of light genetic tweaking together with cross-species fertility regulation via immunocontraception, tunable gene drives, and so forth. It's going to be possible to replace traditional Darwinian ecosystems based on creatures eating each other, and essentially most creatures just starving to death. Hunger, starvation kills more than predation. But it is in the longer run, by which I mean over the next few centuries, going to be possible to design compassionate ecosystems. Before letting philosophers loose on the global ecosystem, prudence dictates conducting pilot studies, and it will be possible to have self-contained artificial biospheres and use fertility regulation, tunable gene drives, CRISPR and its successors, essentially to have models of what a happy biosphere looks like. There will be teething problems. Goodness knows there will be. There are going to be ethical dilemmas too. Why talk about this? I mean, any animal activists listening, or at least many animal activists listening, would probably say the kindest thing we could do to non-human animals is to leave them alone. And there is something rather fanciful talking about a blissful living world while humans are systematically harming non-humans in factory farms and slaughterhouses. But unless we have this kind of debate now, it's possible to waste a lot of time, effort, resources on initiatives such as rewilding, which I think is extremely misconceived, captive breeding programs for big cats and so on. It's important to have this overarching ideal or regulative ambition of a world without involuntary suffering, even if some of the more far out stuff isn't exactly imminent.
I got to congratulate you on having the most adorable solution to a vegan's cat dilemma, or certainly in my case, aspirant vegan, because I agonize over the kills my cat brings home. I've committed to keeping the cat. She is a murderous carnivore and she tortures her prey. And I got to say, Tiddles's catnip flavored culture meat is genius and adorable. I think that's absolutely beautiful. And you're right, I think, about biospheres, a bit like Biosphere 2 in the Arizona desert. They would be, again, a beautiful idea where you could put a herbivore a herbivore mutual ecosystem in there. Of course, if you add Mars as a blank slate, you could just fill your boots, couldn't you? But I guess biospheres would be the way to go. So I wonder, does that mean we're going to see sort of stingless wasps, vegan lions, and philosopher dolphins? And yeah, I always get the philosopher dolphins in because David knows I'm a big fan of Uplift. I'm very pro Uplift, especially for sentient beings that are kind of captive, you know, or at the mercy of their own Darwinian environment. But would this mean on a like a microscopic level or bigger? Does this mean parasites will be upgraded to symbionts?
Intuitively, the hardest creatures, sentient beings to help are the smallest. This is why initially can strike one as so absurd, the idea of a pan-species welfare state. How on earth is one going to help obscure marine invertebrates and rodents in Amazonia and you name it? But paradoxically, and this is something I couldn't have anticipated back in 1995, tunable synthetic gene drives actually make helping small, fast breeders easiest. Essentially, let's say one takes, here's another example, the SCN9A gene, the so-called volume knob for pain. Nonsense mutations abolish the capacity to experience not just pain, but the function of nociception, and that would be premature. But let's say one wants to have a benign version, benign allele of SCN9A, push it across entire species. This is possible with gene drives that cheat the laws of Mendelian inheritance. And in the case of small, fast breeders, one can push these benign alleles, at least in principle, across entire species. In the case of slow reproducing elephants, it's more complicated. But yeah, the abolitionist project, Paradise Engineering, embraces even the most humble minds.
Oh, that is a stunning concept. What was the expression you used to do with the ecosystem and the food chain not being a food chain, being this kind of mutually inclusive pan species
welfare state?
Pan species welfare state, what a gorgeous expression. I will be bandying that about quite a lot in the next few weeks.
Not in front of an American audience, because whereas in front of...
Oh, it's worse than that, mate. It's Australian. What the bloody hell? No, this is going out on Australian radio. You're going to get lynched. Right, okay. Which kind of brings me on, actually, to... I know David Wood is a big fan of kind of a technological window singularity or watershed of technologies by 2035, and I'm inclined to agree with him. I think if we get the Luddites out of the way, there'll be like orders of magnitude of technology rapid firing. So I'm going to ask, is your greatest obstacle not a technological or even economic frontier, but the philosophical political zeitgeist of the day, what you call, and it's an expression I love, and you gave it to me, the Overton window, which is defined as the spectrum of ideas on public policy and social issues considered acceptable by the general public at any time. Given that you're only ever going to move at the speed of lowest common denominator, which sometimes goes much faster in retrograde, how can you, David Pearce, or how can we, if we want to have a pan-species inclusive state, open or widen or smash the Overton window?
Very good question. And unfortunately, I'm essentially a writer who with difficulty can force himself to talk a bit. But to shift the Overton window, I think we need some powerful influencers, charismatic young people. Maybe this would be ideal, an Elon Musk or a billionaire or something like that to shift the Overton window. Yeah, and personally, yes, as I said, I am weakest here. There is no obvious transmission mechanism for, spouting off these ideas and turning them into practical politics. There are now transhumanist parties, both in the States and elsewhere. Whether transhumanists should be aiming for political power ourselves or instead encouraging existing political parties to steal our clothes, I don't know. Sometimes I have this vision of the equivalent of a Greta Thunberg haranguing the United Nations or its arm, the World Health Organization, to live up to its responsibilities for good health to all. But yeah, candidly, and this is a very uninspiring message, the political social obstacles I find utterly daunting. More than anything else, though, I think the challenge is less ideology than simple status quo bias. And you just have to look at the reaction to the first CRISPR babies in China. Now, admittedly, the first CRISPR babies in China were not conceived in ideal circumstances. The scientist in question almost certainly wasn't being straightforward. Rather than trying to confer protection against HIV, he was almost certainly trying to create smart babies, intelligent babies, with or without the consent of the parents in question, because the particular genetic mutation in so-called animal models enhances intellectual performance. In terms of a blueprint for political change, I'll be honest here, I'm weak here. Part of me has some sort of faith in some kind of technological determinism, and that just as well as, let's say, radical anti-aging therapies, when they are developed, essentially more and more people are going to use them. There's going to be rapid take up. Part of me assumes, in some sense, in the long run, it is probably inevitable that as we do gain control, mastery over our reward circuitry, we are going to witness this hedonic uplift. But right now, you're getting a lot of waffle from me. And David... David, to his credit, you see, there is, the mainstay of transhumanism in the UK, the nuts and bolts of organisation building. It is incredibly important, essential, building the transhumanist movement. It requires a very different set of political skills. But hats off to everything David has done.
Would it not be a case of, like, for example, you want to end suffering for the entire ecosystem? A bloody good place to start is human psychology and physical pain. And so starting our in our own biopsychiatry would be, for me, a seemingly sensible and logical start point. And could you kind of give it like a double edge? Like, this sounds a bit eugenicist, right? But expanded compassion and expanded intelligence a part of tinkering with our own biopsychiatry anyway? So it's about raising IQs and it's about raising compassion, and having a sort of a pan-species welfare state would be kind of an inevitable consequence.
Well, if one's conception of intelligence involves not simply the autistic conception of intelligence measured by IQ tests, but also a transhuman, eventually superhuman capacity for perspective taking, then I think something akin to a pan-species welfare state would probably be inevitable. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned IQ. Yes, there are going to be genetic interventions whereby prospective parents can raise the IQ of their kids. But in doing so, they will probably also be raising the AQ, the autism quotient, because there are all sorts of trade-offs between an autistic cognitive style and an empathetic cognitive style.
That does seem to be the case.
And so yes, there needs to be a debate, not merely as what is the kind of the optimal IQ for kids and civilization, but what is the optimal AQ? And this is very crude. Having a low AQ involves far more than simply empathy. It involves a kind of rich capacity for perspective taking, Machiavellian intelligence, sometimes a whole raft of other skills too. And I think raising intelligence, creating more intelligent beings, is technically more challenging than simply raising mood, default, hedonic set point, hedonic range.
You're absolutely right. We can talk about specialization, can't we? Specialization of certain brands of intelligence, and autism almost sort of makes a bolt for extremely high IQ with perhaps a few social skill trade-offs. And that, I know that's probably the popular sort of image of autism, but I'm just using that as shorthand to say that, yes, whereas somebody who is more Machiavellian can also be very charming and more prone to psychopathy, I think, albeit in a very small way. So, I don't understand the mechanics of it, but I know that, yes, I agree with you that there are trade-offs. Massive trade-off. So it's not just a case of turn up the volume IQ, turn up the volume on compassion. It's more Phyto than that, isn't it?
Indeed, yes.
Imagine if we did get to a world where we had a pan-species welfare state, basically a Garden of Eden, and we were enjoying wonderful, wonderful kind of levels of supragenius and compassion. Is it possible that we could find ourselves living in permanent shame as a species that had a systematic mechanized form of predation of other animals, seeing other sentient life as mere food or commodity, merely to delight our palates or to adorn ourselves with bits of their corpse? So, or do we just switch off the guilt setting, if that is the case? Because if we do get to Eden and there's sentient beings, sentience and sort of social intelligence arising in other animals, we've got some answering to do, haven't we?
Indeed, yes. Just as we look back at the institution of slavery with incredulity, how on earth can we treat of Caucasian people have treated people from sub-Saharan Africa so abysmally. I suspect our grandchildren, let alone transhumans and posthumans, will look back with horror or incredulity that we could have treated. Yeah, essentially, a pig, for example, is as sentient and demonstrably as sapient as a pre-linguistic toddler. And yeah, if one is discussing something like the sort of child abuse, people will say, well, child abusers should be locked up for life, and then they'll tuck into a bacon sandwich.
It's a horror story, absolutely. It's if they are, you know, particularly with the British working class, who are on red alert for child abuse and quick to accuse. And it's just like, you know, we believe in the sanctity of children. We really believe. It's like, well, you know, you're tucking into a pre-linguistic 3-year-old toddler now, mate. it is a horror story, and it's something that I have really had a bad time with lately. Is that okay? So our descendants might not have been the perpetrators of the crime, but they might be sort of answering to other animals for being the inheritors of the spoils of that crime. So I just wonder if we'll be in a permanent state of apology, or if we just turn the guilt off and go, well, sorry about that, but let's look forward. It's a bit like undoing all the research that you've got from animal experiments in the past. It's just, throwing that research away is almost as blasphemous as having it. So I think it'll be a very tricky moral maze, personally.
Yes, I mean, just as I mean, most of us today, including people who are very left liberal and woke, which I would tend to be, don't take seriously the idea of reparations for slavery or anything like that. It's not as though kind of collective racial guilt or anything like that. And yeah, I think what matters is stopping the horror, not useless guilt beyond that. But yeah, critical though is going to be accelerating the development, commercialization of cultured meat, because this will bring wonderful moral clarity to the discussions when people find that they can continue to eat meat and animal products, but in a cruelty-free guise. I think, yeah, there is going to be a moral revolution to most people are callous. They're not malicious. And once there is no longer any kind of personal incentive to support factory farming, slaughterhouses, the whole apparatus of animal abuse, I suspect most people will go along not merely with closing factory farms and slaughterhouses, but yeah, even the vision of a pan-species welfare state. I mean, so long as taxes don't need to be raised. And it's very unscientific, but watching people's response to gory wildlife videos on Facebook, for example, although our fair selection of young men making bloodthirsty comments, commentators are saying, "Oh, why didn't the cameraman intervene to rescue the zebra or the baby elephants?" Most of us do not like to witness suffering. It's not just virtue signaling that witnessing suffering of others, humans and non-humans, causes us discomfort, sometimes pain. Most of us aren't mirror touch synesthetes, but if you stumble across or going for a walk, either a toddler or a non-human animal in distress, it is upsetting. And this basic impulse for decency, however attenuated and far from universal, I think this basic spark of decency allied to technology is going to enable us to complete the abolitionist project and create life based on gradients of bliss. Because yeah, right now it would be monumentally challenging to have a 100-year plan to get rid of involuntary suffering, but eventually it's going to become technically trivial. I mean, every cubic meter of the planet is going to be computationally accessible to micromanagement and control. There are kind of Orwellian scenarios, but equally there are more benign scenarios too. And yeah, imagine, and this is a fanciful thought experiment, that yeah, essentially you could just twiddle the dials, that the level of suffering or happiness in the world was an adjustable parameter. What settings would you use? And I can broadly guess what your David would answer, but I think this is generally true, that other things being equal, most people will favour a happy and eventually a super happy biosphere. When I say biosphere, yeah, realistically, we are going to expand beyond Earth. I'm sceptical we're going to be star hopping anytime soon. We've all seen a lot of episodes of Star Trek, but it's by no means clear that sentient life is going to radiate beyond the solar system. If you believe in digital sentience, maybe that's possible, though this will take us off on some very different topics, but this discussion has been very earthbound. But as far as we know today, suffering exists on one planet and one planet only, and that's Earth. And before going on to more ambitious stuff or trying to colonize the galaxy, let's tackle the problem of suffering here.
When I read your passage on the re-encephalization of emotion, it did hit home to me that we really don't have free will at all. The fact that we have to create a neurological architecture to feel happy means no matter how exotic we're always going to be slaves to some form of stimuli in a feedback universe. So my question is twofold. Am I right about that? And could we somehow access a mechanism for free will, given that it seems to be so important for people? People pursue free will like they pursue flight. Could we somehow program a space for a magic porridge pot of autonomy or some quantum eye in the storm that is out of the jurisdiction of genes and classic physics? We crave free will. It's part of, I don't know why we do, but we do. Do we have free will, and can we achieve it with the model that you're proposing?
Well, if I were to put on my physicist hat, and physics brings out my inner Dunning-Kruger, no, as far as I can tell, all that exists is the continuous, linear, unitary, deterministic evolution of the universal wave function. So that nails the possibility of free will. Essentially, we are all slaves to physics. However, in practice, free will, what most people probably have in mind is this sense of felt agency, volition. I've never been able to track down this original study, but I recall as a teenager reading of some experiment where the subject had electrodes on the cortex. On the first occasion, stimulation of the electrodes, the subject's hands shot up and the subject said to the experimenter, "Wow, you did that." But then the experimenter put the electrodes in an adjacent area. The subject's arm went up and the subject said, "I decided to raise my arm." Essentially, it will be possible to isolate the molecular signature or signatures of volition and massively amplify them, so people have a much deeper and richer sense of voluntary agency.
Oh my God, twiddle the knobs on perceived voluntary agency at least.
So I've been listening to what's really been a thoroughly fascinating conversation, and there are many interesting points that have arose. Let me just, by way of summary, highlight a couple that I thought were particularly illuminating. The example of this lady, Jo Cameron, that I'd learned a bit about before, but I can see that many aspects of her recent experience have been written up online. There's a great article in New Yorker from last year that explain and give examples of her being a fully vibrant, emotional person. She hasn't lost her emotional ability just because she has less awareness of pain than the rest of us. So that seems a very encouraging part of the story. And it turns out that as far as Jo Cameron's aware, her own father probably was in a similar situation to her, although he has died quite a few years ago. And her son has inherited, it seems, at least half of her tendencies, which is interesting. So naturally, some people will listen to this example and say, why can't more people be like Jo Cameron? It's part of the vision you've been sharing with us, David. So what can people do if they like this vision and they want to accelerate it in various ways? And this is what we were talking about with the notion of the Overton window, that we need to change what people are comfortable discussing, and that some ideas that people might in a deep part of their mind like, but they're afraid to admit that they like because of what they deem will be socially acceptable. And we're all in the business of trying to change this Overton window. You mentioned, David, about the activities of the political parties with transhumanism in their name, such as the UK's transhumanist group, Transhumanist UK. And there is a campaign brewing in which the goal is to bring new ideas into the political discussion. Perhaps some people will vote for Transhumanist UK, but we are also happy if other parties steal our phrasing. So there are things in our draft manifesto that are more traditional transhumanist, if you like, such as healthcare for open-ended youthful lifespans and uphold morphological and social freedom. But there are also things in this draft set of campaign policies that are closer to what we've been hearing today, such as selectively embrace genetic editing, incentivize meat from non-sentient sources, and accelerate access to neurotechnologies and psychoactive substances. So perhaps when these topics are discussed in political debates, perhaps if there is a transhumanist UK candidate for various political positions, these ideas will feature and other parties will be asked in turn to give their response to such policies. So that's one way in which I'm interested in changing the political discussion. But then there's also the notion of a good coffee table book in which people will have a visually attractive summary of some of these ideas. So I gather you're working on a project, David, in which in due course such a book might appear, which takes some of your earlier writing a step further, not just in terms of the latest information, but presents it in a way that might reach more people. Can you give us an update on how that project's likely to develop?
Yes, thank you, David. I wrote The Hedonistic Imperative, this online manifesto, back in 1995. And it's written, unfortunately, in rather clotted academic prose, because originally I'd intended the manifesto to be for analytic philosophers. Halfway through, I realized, hey, it's possible to reach a much broader audience. And in general, my original motherlode website, headweb.com, state-of-the-art web design, 1997. Essentially, everything needs an update. And the purpose of my forthcoming book, The Biohappiness Revolution, is to outline the abolitionist project, the prospect of paradise engineering, creation of a new architecture of mind based on gradients of intelligent bliss, in a much friendlier, less jargon-ridden way. Also, though, an update on the science, because back in 1995, something like cultured meat was still science fiction. Back in 1995, yeah, the human genome hadn't decoded. No one had any idea about gene drives. So, yeah, essentially, it's an overview of my work. I can't yet promise a publication date. There is a section on the morality, the ethics of it all. I'm personally a secular Buddhist, negative utilitarian. I think our overriding ethical obligation is to minimize, mitigate, and prevent suffering. But the beauty, one of the many beauties of hedonic recalibration of life based on gradients of intelligent bliss, is that it's not necessary to buy into any form of utilitarianism. It's not even necessary to be secular, that whether you are religious, whether you are a secular scientific rationalist, if you are prepared to embrace the vision of a world without involuntary suffering, then biotechnology gives us the tools for the job. The Biohappiness Revolution, given that rather than being some kind of one-off event, in practice, it's going to embrace centuries if we're optimistic, millennia if we're pessimistic. It's more of a transition, but nonetheless, yeah, the world's last experience below hedonic zero will mark a major evolutionary transition in the development of life. I won't live to see it, probably, but nonetheless, I regard it as a vision worth striving for.
I wonder about this pessimistic note here, that you won't live to see it and that it may take, in the worst case, millennia, and in the best case, centuries. Why isn't there the possibility of an exponential speed up when more people become alive to the possibilities and suddenly campaign for it, when a much larger proportion of the Earth's research activities and scientists' projects are dedicated to this?
Yeah, revolutionary breakthroughs are possible, but I very much hope that the approach to defeating aging pioneered by Aubrey de Grey is much more closely integrated with opt-out cryonics and opt-in cryothanasia, so that essentially no one needs to feel left out. And yeah, I can't sensibly predict what will be the case for younger listeners, but for older listeners in their 40s, 50s, 60s and beyond, I'm personally skeptical that unless they sign up for cryonics or cryothanasia, which would take a shift in regulatory framework, that they are going to live to see this glorious future of paradise engineering I write about. If you sign up for cryonics and you're suspended in optimal conditions, I think there is a fairly reasonable chance of your grandchildren or great-grandchildren or maybe even post-human superintelligence reanimating you. In that sense, injecting a note of hope. And as I said, because my own temperament is that of melancholic, depressive, it could be that my pessimism about timescales is misplaced.
If the problem were a technical one, then we could look to the progress with artificial intelligence as likely providing the good solutions. And if the problem is instead a social and philosophical one, then we can look at examples of slow followed by fast changes in attitude, which have taken place elsewhere in the philosophical spectrum and arguably should take place now. So for one, I'm not giving up on the vision that the Paradise Engineering project could be substantially complete by around the middle or second half of this century.
I kind of agree. I sort of see as kind of, all bets might be off, but I'm sort of investing in the idea that the AI will just go nuts, that it will be exponential growth of machinery, IQ. So it's rather like the Enigma machine was sort of one way of flattening the war. I mean, it wasn't the only way, of course, but it certainly helped. So I'm kind of invested in AI exponentially growing over a short period of time. I think it's doable.
The project needs optimists. It really does. It's optimists who get things done.
Yeah, and it's a very, they talk about it in business a lot. Often naive entrepreneurs don't know what they can't do and consequently end up successful. It is the minority of them. It's kind of the exception that proves the rule, but it is a significant minority that do that, and I think it's a case of, like, you know, like 50 Cent says, get rich or die trying. I think it is morally urgent, and I think I've got not many other hobbies other than liberating people from their suffering by hook or by crook.
Yeah, I mean, I wish with a straight face I could look people in the eye and do a Ray Kurzweil, 2045, the year humans become immortal, saying, well, possibly later this century or sometime next century, it just doesn't have the same resonance, it's not inspiring in the same way. But as David was rightly saying, that, yeah, we are witnessing exponential growth in some areas of knowledge, in some areas of technology, and maybe there will be truly revolutionary breakthroughs too.
Did you say there was a tour associated with your book, The Biohappiness Revolution?
Yeah, after COVID, and goodness knows when that is going to be, yeah, I do hope to have some sort of book tour. Yes, I can't offer you details there, but yeah, essentially to promote the book. So, you know, promotion doesn't come naturally to me, but yeah, the message deserves to go mainstream. It really does. And I honestly think that, you know, a few centuries, or pessimistically, a few centuries from now, the idea that life should be based entirely on information-sensitive gradients of bliss, it won't even be controversial. It'll just be just totally self-evident. I mean, as far as I can tell, my tiny kind of role in the scheme of things is to bang the drum, try to update the science a bit. The science itself will soon date, but nonetheless, one needs to go into enough technical detail to show people it's not just philosophizing that, if we can achieve some kind of consensus that it really is technically feasible. So, yeah, as long as I can do productive work, that's what I intend to do, bang the drum for the biohappiness revolution.
And to help you bang the drum, if perchance there's any documentary makers listening to this discussion, are you open to some of them approaching you and featuring you in some of their work?
Oh, very much so. Though my bodily avatar doesn't quite evoke the post-human paradise I talk about.
No, you're quite good looking, David. You're quite good looking.
Oh, let's say it doesn't evoke post-human paradise. No, seriously, though, any documentary maker with an eye and an ear for visually compelling material to be very welcome. I mean, Adam Ford has done a bit of work in this area. Probably too much in the way of me talking heads, and Melbourne Botanical Gardens doesn't quite convey the full horror of Darwinian life read in tooth and claw. But any documentary maker who does think this would make a pan-species welfare state a good topic for a documentary, please get in touch. Yes, thank you, David.
And for those who don't know, Adam Ford is based in Australia.
Thank you for that. I think you should do a feature-length documentary for cinema release, personally. Yes, and write lots of science fiction, and be a media whore like Michio Kaku or Brian Cox or Carol Vorderman. You know, just get out there and do adverts for butter and stuff, and just get yourself out there.
Well, it could convey the horror of Darwinian life more if I were eaten by a crocodile or something. In one of the little mini documentaries, there was a fly that was molesting me. Apparently, unkind folk were hoping I was going to swat the fly and undermine my plea for high-tech Jainism and the sanctity of life, but I didn't do that.
Yeah, it's a hypocrisy on display for all the world to see.
A thing I also was struck by is the phrase by Intel's Andy Grove, "Only the paranoid survive," which David Pierce mentioned earlier. It made me think a lot because, of course, we do need these negative psychological attributes to survive in the environment where we find ourselves. In other words, if we are talking about transforming individual human psychology, we need to at the same time to consider how the broader environment and broader ecosystem evolves too, which I guess makes the problem bigger and harder. But at the same time, once the environment starts changing, then individual psychologies may more rapidly change too. There should be a question at the end of that, but it's a new thought that I wrote down and underlined in my own notes.
I just wonder if we did go down that route. I don't see the logic of alien warfare, but will we be prepared for a fight with extraterrestrials if we became so kind of
laid back?
Yeah, space Buddha.
Personally, I'm a rare earther. Well, Eric Drexler calls the thermodynamic miracle of life's genesis means that I think life-supporting Hubble volumes where primordial life arises more than once could well be very rare. So I think we are probably typical in being alone within our Hubble volume, but we know this. Someone like Robin Hanson, for example, would probably beg to differ here. I think as long as the possibility of suffering sentient beings existing in our Hubble volume exists, that, yeah, we have a responsibility to ensure that we have discharged all our cosmological duties. Cosmic rescue missions are probably going to be unlikely, but nonetheless can't rule them out. But yeah, my own solution to the Fermi paradox is that, we are alone within our cosmological horizon.
I'd like to say thank you for imparting the phrase Hubble volume. I will be bandying that about in the next few days, like I've always known what it meant. So I'm grateful for that.
Oh, sorry.
I didn't mean that. I mean, thank you for another way in which to posture. Yes. So I like phrases like that. And it's self-explanatory. Yeah. The area that the Hubble can peer into, basically, isn't it? Which is huge, isn't it? So it's I'm guessing, or have I got that wrong? Not the area, the volume that the Hubble can
have. No. Yeah, it's essentially. this would take us further afield into the realm of cosmology, which I hadn't intended to do. But my best guess is that, from my secular Buddhist perspective, that once we have got rid of the biology of suffering, we will have discharged our distinctively ethical responsibilities. But we don't know this yet. It is, of course, possible that suffering sentience exists elsewhere, in which case, if it's accessible, we have an obligation to do something about it.
So you're a fan of uplift for imprisoned species?
Yes, you might say.
On a dying planet in an ocean with no thumbs.
Yes, uplift means different things to different people. I don't personally see a desperate need to, enhance the intelligence of members of other species. I think it is ethically most important to ensure they don't suffer. But uplift, yes, by all means.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, David Pearce. I think that just about wraps it up for this episode of Humanity Unshackled with David Pearce. There will be tons of stuff in the show notes.
Most of my stuff is online. Magnus Finding did a collection of some of my essays. And the Biohabitist Revolution is going to be paperback, hardback, hopefully a Spanish translation too, and other stuff. But essentially anyone who is interested can access my material online, starting with the Motherload site, headweb.com.
Excellent. Thank you very much. So everything pertaining to you, David, will be in the show notes. So thank you very much for joining us on Humanity Unshackled. It has been intimidating, mind expanding and nourishing. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Russell, David.
It's been a great show. I've really enjoyed listening to it. Thanks to both of you.